Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for getting up early and joining us at CounterPulse. On behalf of CounterPulse and the Alliance for California Traditional Arts, I want to welcome you to an all-day symposium that is inspired by and discussing the ideas provoked by the Performing Diaspora Festival that's happening this weekend, next weekend, and the following weekend here at CounterPulse. We are really honored and excited to have three panels with really remarkable artists who are joining us to discuss some of the ideas, impetuses, and questions behind their work. And I'm going to get us started really quickly. Just a little bit of housekeeping. We are recording this for podcast. We expect the audience for this conversation extends well beyond this room. And for that reason, we have mics for the panelists on the table. But if you in the audience want to talk, and I hope that you do, make sure that this microphone makes it to you before you start talking. And we'll facilitate that later in the day. If you would like to purchase tickets for Performing Diaspora, we are selling tickets out in the lobby, so you can talk to Micah, our house manager, during any of the breaks. And your clipboard has a bunch of information that's useful if you plan on staying for the day. We have some information about where to find food for lunch, how the whole series of panels will unfold, and also a demographic survey, which helps us tremendously to learn about our audiences and also to get money from funders. So if you wouldn't mind filling that out, that would be wonderful for us. Performing Diaspora has been made possible with the support of over 30 different organizations that have partnered with CounterPulse for each of the events as part of the festival. And several of the organizations are here today and will be introduced throughout the morning and afternoon. Briefly, before we pass it off to Sherwood and Lily and the ACTA group, I want to introduce Mary Armentrout from the Dance Studies Working Group at UC Berkeley, one of our co-presenters for today's symposium.
Thank you, Jessica. Let's see, I'll stand here where I can see everybody. So I just wanted to say a brief hello on behalf of the Dance Studies Working Group of UC Berkeley, which as independent choreographer, not at all affiliated with UC Berkeley, I am, of course, the representative of, which if you know anything about it, actually makes sense. The working group at Berkeley is a wonderful and odd situation where it's a group of working academics and a bunch of people just like me, and probably a lot of you, who are working artists in the field who get together to discuss issues relevant to the field in a slightly academic way. And I find it a really wonderful situation where those of us who are working artists can actually bring our deep thoughts about what we do to this group that is also very engaged in doing deep thinking. And to help kind of create a synergy. So if any of the people here would like to come over and join us, that's one of the reasons that I thought it would be very wonderful to talk to you all, because I feel like anyone who would come to this symposium would be a wonderful participant in the Dance Studies Working Group. And just to have you know that it exists and that you are all actually people who could be part of it, I think is a very useful thing. So glad to be part of this. And
thank you so much, Mary. So now I'm going to turn the morning over to Sherwood Chen and Lily Karazi of the Alliance for California Traditional Arts and let them introduce our esteemed panelists.
Okay. Hi, everyone. I'm Lily, and I want to tell you a little bit about the Alliance for California Traditional Arts, who's been working along with CounterPulse to think about these ideas that are being provoked by this series. ACTA, the Alliance for California Traditional Arts, is a funder, and we work throughout the state of California to seed money for projects and apprenticeships in order to continue traditional and folk arts from the past into the future. And every day of our existence, we're always talking about what is tradition. So this is our favorite topic. We live for this. It's something that we have not. We don't have hard and fast rules about what is tradition, because tradition is as elastic and as myriad as the people who have created them, those cultural communities that have created them. So I invite you to go to our website to learn more about our programs and to see how you might apply to them. And we have the great distinction, Sherwood and I, of working with our colleagues also who are in Fresno, and there are two other people who make up the mighty ACTA, and that's Amy Kitchener, our executive director, and Amy Lawrence, who holds together lots of threads as our administrative person. So all four of us serve the state of California and beyond. please go to our website, actaonline.org, and talk to us a little bit about how you might fit in with your work and your communities.
Thank you so much for coming this morning. I'm Sherwood Chen, working with Lily Karazi at ACTA. We are so honored this morning to be able to have Russell Rodriguez and Gregory Makoma here this morning with us. Today's panel is going to be focusing on criticism and aesthetics, particularly as it pertains to tradition-based artists. This is part of this weekend and the next 2 weekends with Performing Diaspora. We're working with 13 artists throughout the state in developing new work and experimentation and innovation from a traditional base. And so we wanted to bring these two here to really begin to instigate some conversation, to have them share some of their perspectives on these issues, and then to talk about what constitutes good performance and whose values are those, and the kind of role that of innovation, respective to and the tensions that exist between innovation and tradition, and how the two are not necessarily opposed or contradictory to one another, and to talk about mainstream and what does that mean, mainstream and dominant aesthetic, and how one creates work respective to that, particularly if we're coming from a base and a basis which isn't necessarily aligned with that. So that's just a really brief overview, and Lily and I are going to talk a little bit more about these details before launching in. But Lily, did you want to talk about the structure of the panel and how we want to?
All right. Well, the first half of the panel will be presentations by our esteemed participants, Russell and Gregory, and then we're going to open it right up for a back and forth in the dialogue. And a lot of what we start this morning is going to bleed into the rest of the panels. They're so intertwined, many of the topics. But it's really, we're a small enough group that I think that we can all drive this together and make it a conversation. So after our initial presentations, let's just open it up and talk together.
Now, just to let you know that after this panel, there's going to be two others in addition to a participatory polyrhythmic lecture demonstration by Adia Whitaker, who's one of the artists here performing this weekend. And the other two panels are going to be focusing on issues of cultural appropriation and how tradition-based artists are also looking at their work from a social justice lens. So I think that, as Lily says, some of the things that are going to come up in this conversation will probably be interwoven with some of the other topics that we're going to be looking at later today. And we do hope that you can stay for as much as you can today. One of the themes that we were really looking at, and we're talking to Russell and Gregory about when we were looking at this panel, was taking a look at innovation and what that means. Oftentimes, what we find is that there is a gap, which is one of the things that informs this whole Performing Diaspora Festival, where there are those who feel like a tradition-based artist who is experimenting and who is developing work is not traditional enough. And on the other end, there are some programs or curators or presenters who are trying to, they value innovation, but they may not necessarily recognize a tradition-based artist's work as innovative enough, and what does that mean? And so I think that was a big question in terms of looking at the role of cultural expression and cultural values respective to one's work and experimentation.
So we also, we're questioning identity, and is all culturally specific work or all artwork, is it all about explaining who we are, and is it important, and who we are culturally, who we are individually? Is there a driving narrative underneath all of it that just keeps pushing? And is it problematic? And we have ideas about romantic identities, nostalgic portrayals of who we are, particularly in the culturally specific world. And is it a reaction? Or is it resistance to the dominant culture? And then there's the whole idea of colonized mentalities. Whose work are we presenting? What does that practice reinforce or resist? And then there are state and conservatory imprints of how you should portray your selves in art. artist, is that something that distinguishes this work, or how do you feel about it? And again, what is the assertion of the individual, particularly from a group identity? What kind of role do they play?
Another thing that came up was talking about audiences in terms of criticism, aesthetics. It all exists in response in relationship to an audience. And so, you know, particularly we asked Russell and Gregory, and also are asking you, if you're an artist, who are you making work for? And sometimes that answer changes and shifts depending upon who you're making work for, and how does the process change when you do make work for different audiences? And this is also taking a look at audiences in terms of, you know, insiders, outsiders, what does that mean, and what are the interplays of those kind of things respective to your work as a performer?
And then lastly, and broadly, this idea of mainstream, how do mainstream standards of beauty and value compromise or propel or impact an artist's work? Do artists, cultural communities seek validation from that mainstream in order to find some value? And, you know, an example of that is of these television shows that have really propelled dance into the national consciousness. And, you know, there are 25 million people who now know the word Kathak because they've watched this Kathak star sort of propel her 15 minutes of fame into the consciousness of television viewers. Mm-hmm. So lots to talk about, and
so
introduce our panelists.
We wanted to take a couple of minutes just to lay it all out, because we wanted you all to think about these things as Gregory and Russell, you know, address these issues. And without further ado, we just want to give a brief introduction for those who may not be familiar with their work. And I just wanted to start by introducing Gregory Ma'oma. And this is his flyer. He's here in town to perform, and tonight is his last night at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. So we do recommend that you go and see his powerful virtuosic solo. And tonight is the last night. Let me read you his bio. Gregory is a contemporary African dance maker who's born and bred in Johannesburg and is regarded as a visionary in his home country. People describe his work as cutting-edge contemporary work to emerge from Africa. Gregory is also the founder and artistic director of Vuyani Dance Theater in Johannesburg. And he received training both in South Africa and in Belgium. As a choreographer, teacher, dancer, artistic consultant, and a creative director, he's taught and presented work internationally all over the world, and has won several awards and accolades both in South Africa and internationally. Gregory also serves as Associate Artistic Director for Moving Into Dance and as the Artistic Director of the Afro Vibes Festival in the Netherlands. And he was the Creative Director for Gauteng Carnival in 2007. He's also a founding member of MUISA, which is the Multi-Arts Initiative of South Africa. Welcome.
Thank you.
Russell Rodriguez. Doctor, PhD, is a University of California President's postdoc fellow. In June of 2006, he received his PhD from the Department of Anthropology at UC Santa Cruz, completing his dissertation under the guidance of Professor Olga Gerard Ramirez. He's currently working on his manuscript about mariachi. Performing the soundscape of Greater Mexico. That's the name of the manuscript, excuse me. Russell has also worked as a curator for the Smithsonian Center for Folklife and Cultural Heritage Annual American Festival, co-curating the Latino Music Program in 2004. He co-produced the Smithsonian Folkways recording CD compilation and songs of the Chicano movement. He's a practicing musician, very active. He's worked as a professional mariachi musician for over 25 years throughout the United States, San Juan, Puerto Rico, Guadalajara, Jalisco. Today, Russell continues to play music professionally with Mariachi Azteca and Los Sonoros del Este, grounding himself in vibrant transnational music scenes. He's in constant dialogue with Chicano and Chicana musicians throughout California, participating in musical collaborations in the Bay Area and LA with members of Quetzal, Was it Matli, Cava, Dr. Loco and his Rock and Jalapenos, La Colectiva, all of which have been highly informative to studies on Latina, Latino, Chicano, Chicana, and Mexican cultural expressions in the United States and abroad. So we welcome you, Russell. Thank you.
So let's get started and jump right in and get some of your thoughts, Russell, on some of these issues.
Okay, well, before we start, I just want to thank you all, Lily, Sherwood, and Compulse, for inviting me to this wonderful opportunity to kind of share some ideas and some thoughts about what we do, you know, and what we believe is important to what, you know, to ourselves. I think I wanted to just give a little background of what kind of scenes I'm working in, and I think the majority of us are probably like maintain multiple identities and multiple talents and multiple dialogues. What I'm working in is like what the little bio brief says is I work in a lot of transnational work. I work in a scene of mariachi musicians in the United States. I'm planted here in the United States in San Jose, California, but my network extends to mostly Guadalajara, Mexico, and L.A. And in that kind of movement, what we understand is the issue of networks and what networks bring to a manner in which people express themselves. And in this, being somebody that has grown up in the United States, who identifies as a Chicano, but working in a very Mexicano type of realm, you know, the idea of multiple identities become not only kind of productive, but they also become very contentious and contradicting. So I think in the work that I do, these are the things that I try to kind of get at is understanding what it means to be a Chicano in a Mexicano space, what it means to represent Mexicanidad to Mexicanos, meaning Mexicanidad, Mexicanness, you know, as a cultural identity signifier. And so so basically the realm of like expression that I work in is music and dance. And I grew up doing folklorico as a young kid in the United States, not understanding any idea of what it was. You know, my mother forced me to go and dance. And it was either play baseball, you know, sports or dance. And I did both for a long time. And then finally I made a decision that I wanted to dance. And it was, and I never, you know, really thought about why. And it wasn't until I was disillusioned with in folklorico that I realized why I picked dance. You know, the understanding of learning traditional arts in the United States in a different type of context, but not getting the type of information that's necessary to understand what you're doing. And so doing folklorico was an exercise of practicing Mexicanidad without any context, without any idea. And in coming to that realization, I had to make a sense of why it was important. And the reason it was important was the manner of community it built, the manner of what kind of skills of talent that we were being, you know, informed. And this happened mostly through, it ended up happening through music more than dance. We would play at these parties, at the weddings and all these things, and to see people dance and create a natural context or, you know, for this to occur was something that kind of opened my eyes. So then and so what the ideas of tradition of something being original, you know, started kind of formulating in a better sense. And this is at the same time where I develop a real specific type of Chicano consciousness for myself. And so it's like when I'm doing all these, you know, doing all these different kind of dance and music, it's like, well, when am I going to do something that's going to really represent where I'm from, which was a Chicano community in San Jose, California? How do I represent that in expressive culture? And this is where I started interacting with all these other Chicano musicians, and also with still the Mexicano musicians themselves, who were also kind of establishing or understanding the context in which they were living in, which was in the United States. So what I want to do is I'm going to play a little excerpt of a piece, and I guess you can interpret this as a traditional song jarocho. And this is, Patrick, can you play that first piece? This is a song called La Llorona, and so this was actually a piece that I did with one of the members of this kind of transnational community of musicians, Omar Gutierrez, who was singing, and then the person that kind of taught us all in San Jose was Artemio Posadas, who kind of created this whole kind of school of traditional music in the Bay Area, who also teaches in Richmond and other places. Now, in this piece, you know, this was a project to create a recording of representing musicians in the United States playing traditional music and from Veracruz and from San Luis Potosí. And in the piece itself, it's like the whole intention was this idea of preservation and promotion of Mexicanidad. But one of the things, you know, if you kind of know the music, is the instrumentation was two jaranas and what we call a leona, this bass requinto. And there's nothing odd about the combination or anything like that, but I think the intention of the leona is a bass instrument and plays more like these boom, 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 rhythmic patterns and more percussive ideas. And here we kind of used it as more of a melodic instrument, and kind of getting this more eerie kind of feeling out of it. Now, but still, you know, this is what I wanted to get out of it, and, you know, whoever else, you know, they're going to do their own thing. I want to play the next piece, which is the same piece. Now, the piece we just played was like a 6-8 rhythm. Dun, 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 dun. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Now I'm taking the same piece and creating a putting it in a 4 meter, a duple meter. And what I used in this one was a dancer named Rubí Oseguera, and I ended up kind of creating a drum kit out of her dancing. Can you play the next piece? Then I added hi-hat. So the intention was with this one was kind of to move away from the idea of preservation and promoting a preserved Mexicanidad, and it was more of a dialogue of creating and practicing something else. And this is kind of where I find myself kind of dealing with the dichotomy of innovation and preservation, you know. But we have to, you know, I think one of the things we have to get, or for me what was important was having a very strong foundation in what people consider traditional. Having that dialogue with traditional practitioners, but understanding the context of where we live is, having a blues harp, a bluesman playing harmonica on it. That was this guy named Hook Herrera. And then having kind of more of a R&B bass line to it. I mean, our foundations is in Mexican music, but we live in a context where our neighbors, you know, we're living next to communities of African Americans, of Asian Americans, of all these different other people that are informing our expressive culture. You know, our foundation is strongly Mexican, but that's not the only influence. It's a U.S. popular culture in general, and that's how we have to and that's finding that voice that kind of shows those different foundations, you know, and that's. And this is where I think for me was filling the gap between innovation and tradition is basically a real life, you know, where everything else is. So I think we'll stop here.
Thanks. You know, that makes me think of actually, and I'm going to read a very brief passage from an essay that Gregory wrote back in 2002 called "Identity, Diversity, and Modernity in Urban Cultural Cocktail." And this was just a passage that you were writing about respective to urban migration, and this just made me. This last comment you were talking about makes me think about it. He writes, "Without doubt, migration to cities leads to urbanization, but being in the city does not automatically constitute one as being urbanized. I believe urbanization is by choice. You choose to live in a city, conform to the new lifestyle, the culture and values systems. Or you choose to work in the city and still practice your traditional beliefs and retain your value systems within the new circumstances. It doesn't, however, make one less African or more African than the other." Mm-hmm. So, leaping from there and, you know, getting some of your thoughts, what are your perspectives?
I would like to start by saying that, you know, when we make art, I don't think we make art for the sake of art, especially coming from an African context. It's always being a response to something, a response to your circumstances, your response to your surroundings, you know, to your people. And so art has meaning, has a source, a very strong source. It comes from somewhere, and it's delivered also within the same context of creating meaning. And I also start also by reading something. It's from a book by Angie Kroch, A Change of Tongue. And this is a professor, Mohamed Mdani, and he says, "Before any agreement can be reached, the concept of traditional leadership in an African context must be understood correctly. Before colonialism, those we refer to as traditional leaders were not the only source of authority. The entire social, economic, and political life of Africans involved various traditional structures. There were structures at the marketplace, within households, in local areas, during initiations, and other rituals. So everyone had a place where their voices counted. women, children, men, the elderly, farmers, herders, chiefs, fathers, uncles, grandmothers, and everyone was accountable to society in general for their decisions. What colonialism did was to select a single structure, namely that of the headman, and declare it the only traditional structure. What is more, this structure was no longer accountable to the people, but to the colonial authority. It was therefore a complete perversion of what had existed before. And a bulk of my work speaks very much in this context of giving authority to individuals, where we can be able to respond to our circumstances, respond to leadership, respond to our social economic backgrounds, but also very much so also to respond to colonial history, as is the case today by most of the artists. But also at the same time, we have, because of the system of apartheid, what it has created in South Africa specifically was to segregate people according to language, according to ethnic group, according to traditional belonging. And so that what that has created was to further separate Africans from coming together and practicing also their traditional forms as individuals. So what it did was to say that, you know, we're creating leaders for your ethnic groups, and then you have to follow your leader. Your leader becomes the headman. He's the one who will set rules for you. But also those rules were set out of rules set by colonial powers. You know, it was the rules of the English and then followed on by the Belgians and the Dutch. You know, and that in its own created structures that further segregated, you know, Africans from connecting with each other. And it did spread out outside South Africa because, you know, there were borders that were erected in the continent. And so that was also a separation from Africans having to trade. And trade, for me, it's also in trading, in cultures. You know, at the moment, with this work, Beautiful Me, it's also, for me, my attempt to trade with other cultures and to find ways in which my own culture can be visible within these other cultures and within these other traditions. It's been difficult for me to separate the traditional form from the contemporary or the modern form. And for me, by being able to kind of, you know, negotiate my place between the two poles, the extreme tradition and actually the extreme contemporary, was for me also negotiating my own evolving cultural history. And I say, you know, culture evolves all the time, but also as I evolve culturally, I'm also acknowledging my past. I'm also acknowledging my tradition, but I would not want to be, you know, the sole representative of that tradition for which I was not even brought up, you know, under those traditional values and forms. I was brought up in a city in Johannesburg, and Johannesburg became a cultural hub of many cultures, and I was not brought up within a single structure or a single traditional form. I was brought up between this mix of cultures, and so forth. And therefore, that mixture created a cocktail, and a cocktail is what I am. I'm a mixture of all these forms and tradition and aesthetics. And that on its own, for me, is an aesthetic. It has created an aesthetic, it has created a form for which it continues to negotiate between tradition and modernity. And also, at the same time, acknowledging that yes, there is tradition. Yes, I belong, I come from a certain tradition, I come from a certain culture that has values and has norms, but also I am not the sole representative of that tradition or form. But I acknowledge it. You know, I say, yes, I'm Xhosa. When people ask me what is your ethnic group, and I say Xhosa, I speak Xhosa, I come from that family of Xhosa-speaking people. But, yeah, I'm also a city man. You know, I travel around the world. You know, I wear suits. You know, I carry a cell phone. And I'm a mixture of a mad heart and internet. So, and that for me makes it exciting because it allows me to have a choice, to have a choice to investigate my traditional forms, to have a choice to study my traditional forms so that it's not a given. I cannot take it for granted that it's given to me that I am black, I'm a South African, and therefore I represent a tradition or a form. But by choice, yes, I want to go back and study those traditional forms and using contemporary forms to do that. And exactly what I'm doing. But modern forms, for me, don't necessarily say I am modern. And also traditional forms don't necessarily say that I am traditional. But what I'm saying is that, you know, I'm using both elements to negotiate the present, but also to open a window for the future. And in so doing, I also acknowledging the fact that I'm traditionalist, specifically talking in a South African context, are also battling with themselves in terms of creating identity, you know, within our diversity. And so the struggle is now, you know, what we're trying so hard to define what is South African or who is a South African within our diversity. And that makes it harder even because, you know, South Africa is seen very much, you know, between the two poles, black and white, and it's still very much evident. And it also, you know, boils down to the history of apartheid in South Africa, the history of colonial power, and it's still very much evident. You walk down the streets of Johannesburg, and you still see, you know, that separation. It's still very much clear in your head. Though we're speaking of a rainbow nation, you know, saying let's bring all these colors together. And how do you do that when? You know, structures and social structures and economic structures are still very much, you know, separated. And they're very clear that you're dealing with extremities. You know, you're dealing with the poor of the poorest, and you're still dealing with the richer of the richest. And that is separated by, there's a color line that separates those two points as well. And so it's not easy to just say, you know, let's talk of a rainbow nation. And I say to people, if we want to talk about rainbow nation, then probably what we need to do is to share power, you know, share power. And by sharing power is not just to say, you know, let's elect a black leader and say it's a black president, and then that way we share power. No, power for me is shared in economic means, you know, let's share the economy. Let's be economically equal, where I can be able to say I want to practice this form, but in practicing this form, I also want, you know, my people, my black people from the township, to be able to enjoy the kind of work that I'm doing. And because structures are there, have been put in place, but those structures have been defined, you know, for the selected few, and for the selected few who are in a position to afford, you know, to go to the theater, and it's not everyone in South Africa can enjoy or have the privilege of going to a theater, and if you do, from a black perspective, then it becomes a luxury. it's a luxury to even go and study dance or modern techniques, because it is a luxury. You know, it's not something that you can wake up and say, you know, I just want to be a dancer, or I want to be an artist, I want to draw. It does not happen, and it does not happen because of the historical history of South Africa, that we've been separated for far too long. And to just get people together and say we're speaking of a rainbow nation, it's almost impossible. I think I'll leave it at that. Yeah. And then when we were just, you know, talking about this seminar and this topic today, and I raised a couple of questions, and those questions, I guess I'm trying to find answers in my work with those questions, but also are the questions that they probably will help us try and understand why we're still creating work. You know, speaking also from an African context, and one of those questions is what is identity in the artistic identity? How do I define my identity within my artistic identity? I guess my artistic identity is getting much more clearer for me, because, you know, it's something that I practice every day. But what is really my identity then? And that's a big question for me. And the second question is, how do we study? Why do we study abroad when our interest and response is in Africa? And for me, it's a very important question, and I've asked myself this question also after I went to study for 1 year in Belgium, and I came out of that, and all I was doing after that was breaking all these rules that were given to me, you know, and structures and ways in which, you know, choreography should be tackled. For instance, or performance should be tackled. And so I found myself breaking all these barriers, breaking all these rules, going against. And so that was the question then, why did I have to, you know, to go abroad and study if I have to respond to my African situation and circumstances. And the third one is, why are we looking to the West for survival of our art? And also, it's my biggest question at the moment, because a bulk of my work is seen in the Western context. And, you know, and when I create these works, you know, I create them with Africa in mind, with my circumstances in mind, because I'm responding to my immediate, you know, circumstances, and also taking history into account, into colonial history into account, and I'm responding to all of that. But it is mostly enjoyed by the West. You know, my work is performed. You know, I would have loved to enjoy an extensive South African tour. I'm not talking even Africa, like I'm enjoying now in the USA, where I'm on tour in the USA, which is great. You know, but it's this kind of tour that makes my work to survive, you know. And in Africa, it's almost impossible for this work to survive. Again, it's financial and economic structures.
Russell, did you have any thoughts about this, respective to the work that you're doing transnationally, but at the same time developing a really solid practice locally speaking?
Mm-hmm. As well. What was coming to mind right now was the idea that we're doing responding to the question of the West, the colonial question. One thing we're doing right now is this practice of fandangos, jarochos, fandangos. There are these music gatherings, dance gatherings. And what's, you know, I just went I was telling Lily that I went to a panel discussion up in Seattle of three women who participate in this in these fandangos. And the three of them, well, two of them, are actually perform with very very artistic groups, highly artistic groups. And so one of the things that kind of came out of this discussion was, you know, the spaces that they're performing in as performers, as artists, is how they're dealing with the structures that you're talking about, these the economic, political, social structures, the state, the industry, you know, and how they're negotiating through those venues, but also kind of trying to ground themselves in a kind of a practice that's dignified, you know, working with dignity, and this is responding to a lot of different movements that are occurring, like in East LA and in Mexico with the Zapatista movement. Yet, you know, you have to follow these venues to if you're going to work, you know, if you're going to survive and doing what you think is important, which is your art, which is your traditional practices, which is your innovative practices. But what's really interesting about these musicians and dancers is that we do have a grounding space for ourselves, which are the fandangos. And we in this discussion, what kind of comes out of it is how it creates, it's almost like this counter-hegemonic space, in the sense that it's open for anybody to practice, anybody to participate as a singer, as a dancer, as a poet, as a cocinera, a cook, as somebody that makes drinks, as somebody that tells stories. And in that, in the United States, it's become a space where we're bringing like diplomats from Venezuela to come and talk, you know, people from all these other struggles to come and share, hip hop artists, visual artists. And in that, it's this openness of, and the discussion was about how women are participating in the space, but what it opened up to is like how everybody, you know, non-Mexicanos, you know, no matter what kind of sexual orientation, no matter, you know, all these very diverse participation. And it's in that idea that it's become a kind of a counter, we were kind of coming to the conclusion that it's like a counter-hegemonic space. And it's necessary to have that space for these performers who end up, you know, performing in these ensembles that are working in folk festivals or traveling through these circuits of the industry, trying to get recordings, you know, trying to get a label to produce the recordings. And I think it was really important to them to always, and one woman even said, we have to protect that space. You know, we have to really work to protect that space and not get to the point where it is, you know, we can't do it unless ACTA gives us a grant to do it, you know? And that's one of the beauties of this kind of the fandango itself. It doesn't depend on that. It depends on the people, you know, more than anything, you know? And so, and this is also kind of resonating with, I just read this book by Alejandro Madrid, and it's called Sounds of a Nation, and he's talking about the construction of hegemonic discourse. Mm. And it was basically about the art music in Mexico with Carlos Chavez and Manuel Ponce and all these guys, and how they had to created a discourse that was corresponding to the national state discourse. And, you know, this idea of an indigenous past and recreating an indigenous past, which nobody really had connection to, you know? So it's this whole imagination that, you know, they were creating this imagined history and representing it in a very artistic form. But then you read, you know, something by like Mexico Profundo by Bonfil Botella says, yeah, but you know, it we can represent the indigenous past, but if we don't talk to the people, or negotiate with the people, or you know, recognize the people, you know, there's you know, what's the meaning in it, yeah. You know, or let the people themselves represent themselves. In that process, in that hegemonic discourse. So in that, you know, thinking about the fandango, it really kind of, it, you know, kind of gets at this, how a counter space, a counter kind of alternative space, where there's also alternative epistemologies of ways of knowing, you know, ways of understanding, that inform us.
We're gonna open it up. And for those of you who have, I just want to explain what fandango is, as someone who is an outsider went to visit, imagine a space much like this, and the center is a wooden platform or a tarima. And not having been to one and not a Spanish speaker, what I saw when I went to visit a San Francisco gathering at Galleria de la Raza was a community of people of all levels of abilities who could play instruments, who were allowed to sing, who were allowed to create on the spot song, and to sing fully at the top of their lungs or with great, great fullness and gusto, all ages in this very, very inclusive space, and this goes on for hours and hours, not unlike the kinds of circles that, you know, you see in other improvised traditions and African traditions where people are invited to come and perform in the center, you know, but again, that creating that kind of energy in that space to allow people to participate without judgment, basically. Question.
I'm sorry. We're recording this, so I'm just going to get this to you.
This is a really great presentations by the panelists and just a great forum. And my question was about, since we talked about dichotomies coming in right from the get-go of this panel's formation and in the introductory remarks, if we were setting up dichotomies around spaces that are being described as counter-hegemonic, like the fandango, as opposed for the other spaces where artists are paid, whether it's in the West or anywhere else. And if there's a way in which that we're creating this sense that artists don't get paid or shouldn't be paid, and there's a purer... No, I mean, that's the question.
Yeah.
If there's a purer space, like the fandango or other creative spaces that is so hierarchically above the spaces where artists are paid, and that is almost like a vulgarization of the artwork or a bastardization of the artwork to be paid. I mean, it seems to me like they're recreating hierarchies, and I'm wondering how and why we continue to do that.
I think it's understanding how you intertwine, like Gregory was talking about, negotiating in between that. And we got to understand, we're always, those are intertwined spaces. And the idea, you have to understand too, in the fandango, there's hierarchy, you know, there's always hierarchy, you know, and it's based on talent or seniority or, you know, who you are, you know, of course. But, the idea that we need both spaces, that's what I was getting at. That's what I really need to get at, is because we have to support those musicians that are working out there in the industry, in this, you know, even within the state, you know, we have to support those musicians or artists, you know, especially because when they're making this effort to represent people that aren't represented, so that's kind of where I'm then.
Speaking as a Chicana who went into a fandango as with the research hat on, if you will, and became a convert to a sort of religious experience, which is, I think, what the fandango does. It is a replenishing sort of a space where you go in with whatever prejudices you have in your life, and as you see the genuineness of the participating group, you understand the original reason why some of these songs and dances happened before we put lights on them and before we put sequences to them and entrances and exits and all those things that you do as dancers and choreographers. And you are there for the pure pleasure of understanding, in my case, something which I recognized as my background, but I couldn't put a handle on it for a long, long time. And it was just the pleasure of it. And you share in this space something which is not about money, but about being another human being with a shared experience, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. And if you are going to put it on stage and do all those things, then you go into another thing and you can simulate it and you can let people see what it might be like, but that is not the essence of it. The essence goes back to that space, and you need to be in that space with those folks. I have, in all my other experiences as an artist, and I have been an artist for close to 40 years now, have never seen hundreds of musicians play without getting paid, except there.
Yeah.
And dancers always dance, but musicians have always been treasured, and this is a place where you can find that. And that is an amazing thing to see. And I only could equate it to a religious experience. When I went down to Mexico, I could not believe that this was not happening somewhere in a school of dance or on a stage someplace, but somebody just put a light thing going across a block, and they closed both sides of the block, and they told people in the houses, we're going to have a fandango. They brought on their own chairs and their own whatever, and they sat there, and then they all participated. Along with this religious experience sense was a real sense of envy that I had in my heart. How could I feel that here, you know, again? And I think it must be a lot of people felt that because it's happened here, as Russell has said. If there is, definitely the artistic connection, but to call it art is only part of the answer, I think. Mm-hmm. It is beyond that. It is really connected to the roots, and I think that's why the Chicano community has reacted so favorably to it, because we have been looking for something like that for a long time. Folklorica was, for us, the answer for many, many years.
It still is.
And it was an incomplete answer. It gave ownership, it gave a sense of tradition to our children, it gave many things, but it never gave us that sense of today. You always had to pretend you were back in the 18th century or something like that, but there is the sense of today. And interestingly enough, for me anyway, it was in the musical world that I found it. I went to a performance by Quetzal, and I heard the music, and I recognized those rhythms because I had been looking for this crossover door that I could never find. And Quetzal was doing it amazingly because they were doing Mexican music, but they certainly had a Chicano sound. It was not, you could dance to it in the nightclubs, you know? And so part of the answer for me was that when I went there, it wasn't about musicians. It was about dancers and musicians and poets and speakers all in the same human being. Literally, these people can do it all. And all in one person. And different levels of abilities. So I just wanted to share that because I think that one was
Thank
wonderful.
Debbie, and then we'll go to this too.
This is for Gregory. You know, when I was listening to you talk, and I found it, and I mean, I don't know much about the art scene in South Africa, but it's always interesting to hear that an artist is more appreciated in the West than in his home region. So, because you made the point that, you know, you're not just creating arts for art's sake, but art as a response to circumstances and leadership. And do you find that since your work is, as you say, enjoyed in the West more than in South Africa, you're inevitably performing for people who don't have an idea about the circumstance or the context or the leadership that your work is created in response to? So do you find yourself as an artist having to contextualize yourself? Or is it ever a problem for you that your primary audience is maybe not coming from a totally informed perspective about the whole larger picture?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I don't even think of... I don't think of an audience as, for me, as defining my path or deciding on the work itself. I think first and foremost is I get moved by a situation, and that situation is mainly either in South Africa or in the continent. And I basically just respond to that, you know. And in mind, it's responding to a situation in an African context. And when I take it out of the African context, and I know that, you know, part of it is lost already, you know, by the time I pack my bags and I leave the country, I know that, you know, there will be a lot of misunderstanding, you know, in my process of negotiating with an audience now in the West. So, and that happens, and that is something that I've learned to accept, you know, because for me it also says, you know, whenever I'm dancing, and especially because, you know, I've been performing most of my work in Europe, and it's always been, you know, it's the only time that I realize that actually I am actually black, you know, when I'm on stage, because, you know, the majority of people in the audience are white. And it becomes a conscious thing at a very moment, you know, and again also the way you deliver the work even changes. You know, because it's like already you're confronting it's there in front of you, what you've been talking about, which you've been responding to, which has happened, has a long history in Africa, and now it's there. These are the descendants, you know, you're right in front of you. So, I don't think about it beforehand, but I think, you know, it hits me when I'm there. It's in the moment.
I hope I'll be lucid. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about tradition, and is it exclusive of innovation, especially if you say that the art is in response to something, right? It's in response to what's going on. So isn't innovation somewhat built into that? And then if you can maybe talk about preservation versus promotion. What is preservation? And then what is promotion? And what happens when you're promoting your art? Change.
Yeah.
I don't
have
questions,
we have two points in I'll speak mainly from South African context because that's what I'm familiar with. You have traditional or traditionalist, and then you have contemporary forms. the traditional forms, we remember we have 11 official languages. That means already you're talking about 11 traditional forms. And then we finish a tradition, there are so many other forms in one tradition. And I say, you know, yes, preserve. You know, we need to preserve our traditions. We need to, you know, we need to know this is part of our history. But what are we preserving from? And that's, for me, it's a big question, you know. We also have to remember that all these traditional forms, as they were practiced, also they had meaning. There was a very clear meaning. There was a very clear meaning for every dance form that was performed. It was either for an initiation ceremony, or it was for a wedding, or it was for to bless a newborn child. There was always a meaning, or preparing for war. So if we preserve them, and I say, yes, do it, in which context are we preserving these dance forms? And that is the question I'm posing, you know, to traditionalists. That I agree with you. We do need, you know, we do need to learn, because we can learn a lot from those forms. But how are we preserving them? You know, and for me is that innovation. If we're saying that, you know, our traditional forms have to be innovative, have to, you know, to change, and then already that is out of context. It's already you've taken it out of, then it's not preservation for me, because already it's changed. And the minute also you put it on stage, the minute you put lights on it, the minute you do anything with it, it's already been changed. You know, and for me, it's just to find clarity between the two things and say, you know, are we saying traditional forms need to be contemporary? Or are we saying that traditional forms have to remain traditional and, you know, and remain in those years? You know, they need to be preserved as they are, or as they were performed, or as, you know, as, and find again reasons to perform them, and perform them only for those reasons.
Russ, would you have a response to that?
Yeah, I think the idea is, I think what we need to think about more is the idea of tradition and innovation as kind of discursive points. And meaning, and I think what you're going to do is find most people, you know, vacillating between those points at different times. And so you have, you know, for instance, when I was doing mariachi music, you have these musicians that are these fabulous, incredible musicians, and they're going to tell somebody. They're going to tell the musicians they interpret as being more traditional, look, you got to learn how to read and write music. You need to learn how to, you know, so you can record, so you can play with a group that's with arrangements and stuff like that. But then they're going to tell these other students who read and write, you know, really well, says, now you got to learn the tradition of, you know, playing from here. You got to have, you know, that sentimiento, that you know. And so it's not really, you know, people... You know, it's just like a discursive exercise more than anything, because people have to be moving back and forth between those in their work, between those ideas. You know,
and we need to be allowed to do that.
Exactly.
And I think that's what is exciting about it, is that we can. It's also acknowledging. By allowing us to move between, it's acknowledging, you know, histories and acknowledging centuries of evolving traditions.
At the same time, it makes me think about the solo that I went to see Beautiful Me last night, and just during the course of your performance, it also made me think, respective to what both of you were talking about, you talking about the space in the fandango and talking about some of the ways in which you, as a city boy in Johannesburg, were really drawing upon multiple sources relative to your own ethnic identity, to pop culture, all of these kind of things. that, you know, with our work at Alliance for California Traditional Arts, we're always concerned with cultural transmission and looking at that flow. But I think it can be a easy, and it's commonplace and it's fine, but the assumption is really looking at it from a sort of, I don't know, a certain axis this way, where you're looking at it over time as a tradition passes down. When I saw your piece and thinking about how you were defining what happens in a fandango, it actually is going in these multiple directions, where you're actually in your sort of relationship in your piece with Akram Khan and with Faustin Lignacula as well. They're your contemporaries, and you're having these kind of dynamic cultural exchanges that are paralleling similar issues of cultural transmission that we're looking at multi-generationally, and that sounds the same as how you were defining a fandango as well.
Nice.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. So my question is, how do you define authenticity, and how do you maintain authenticity when you negotiate between different forms, and also when you innovate within a particular form? It's kind of a big question, so I guess you could take, you know, whatever part of it.
Yeah, I mean, you can't define authenticity in terms of race and ethnicity alone. It becomes an impossible thing to do. I think, you know, you can attempt to define it by looking at various possibilities. And for me, possibilities are not one of those possibilities is to be able to, and not to be afraid to borrow from the other. And by borrowing from the other, it also makes you just to understand the authentic nature of where you come from. And that has helped me quite a great deal to define or to attempt to define where I come from and who am I actually in all these complexities. And for me, that is being authentic about, you know, my being or where I come from. And also it's finding innovation in the process of doing that, you know. And that's why I talked a lot about trading, you know, because I it's trading with traditions, you know, and allowing traditions to inform. But it also helps me to inform myself about my own tradition, you know, to understand it even much better. And for me, is again an attempt to find authenticity in it, you know, and it's an innovation, without being having the sense of that I'm dealing with something that is too precious. And I guess, you know, sometimes traditionalists are too precious, or we're too precious about what we think we own. And for me, tradition cannot be owned. You know, it's something that needs to exist, and it needs to be out there in the open for various negotiations, you know, with it. Otherwise, it becomes just it's like something that is beautiful that we can just look at it and admire, you know, and it becomes then more of an ornament than just something that we can engage with.
I stay away from authenticity. I think one of the things I really like about, I like to go think about the folklore studies. Back in the mid-70s, there was a group of folklorists like Ben Amos, Abrams, and person I look up to is Américo Paredes. And these guys, you know, wanted to redefine folklore studies. And what the main kind of push that they did, especially Amos, was to rethink, you know, expressive culture, traditional arts, and all these things, and not to look at them as cultural inventory, you know, to get a song and categorize it and say, you know, this is the way it is and blah, 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 blah. But to look at what the process is of communication. Think about all these things in folklore and what were those processes that help communicate ideas, certain practice, transmission. Transmission is incredibly important, you know, because, you know, you have all these people. For instance, today you have all these people like looking at traditional forms, you know. So you get a group coming out of a university that's going to play traditional mariachi music. So they can do is find the oldest recordings, and emulate those recordings. And so then all of a sudden you're saying, oh, no, this is a traditional group. These guys are playing. This is the way you're supposed to play. But then you have all these contemporary mariachi musicians that are playing very, people are saying flashy, too arranged, all these things. But all those musicians come from families that have been playing mariachi music all their lives, you know, and it's just that they've continued. Yeah, they've been continuing with the time, and the music itself has to respond to the condition, the circumstances. But the thing is, they have that transmission, this line of transmission that's amazing. And people are totally just not even looking at that stuff. And I think, you know, that's why ACTA is so important.
There's a huge amount of knowledge in this room, and so I wanted to actually, we'll take your comment, but before we do, I just wanted to see if there's anybody in this room who has any thoughts or responses to Naomi's question. Ron? Anyone? Yeah. No.
Not to respond to the question as such, but just to talk about authenticity. In my own view, I'm not sure when we talk about authenticity, what will we be referring to? Because in the South African context, I'll take an example, Zulu traditional dance. If you move from one era to another, it's not the same as we have seen it in the first place you were. But they will call it, no, this is traditional Zulu dance, but the movement is not the same. So will you say, which will you say is authentic to another? So it might be very difficult to define authenticity in that regard. So hence Grigori, as he's doing his body movement, if you want to see more of that, Grigori will refer you to where you can go. As the lady was saying, when she went to Mexico, she was part of that open space where musicians and dancers were, and she saw the genuine part of the music and dance. So with Grigori, she just display what is happening in the country, not in a bigger scale, but this is what can happen in a closer dance in South Africa. But if you want to see more of it, with traditional women wearing a gear for that, go to Eastern Cape. You'll find the genuine of it. Thank you.
Okay, Ron.
There's a question.
Sure, thanks. Gregory, you mentioned this idea of trade and borrowing, which in my mind evokes a sort of mutuality or an understanding between multiple parties. I'm curious, where there's trade, there's also potential for theft or some perception thereof. So I'm curious under what circumstances one would potentially see that as a negative, and when would it be considered more of the other? So curious to get your thoughts about that. Or anyone else's.
I think, I mean, as humans, we're nomadic by nature. You know, we're not supposed to be living in one area and be kept in that area. And again, you know, speaking from an African context, you know, people moved around, and then they met with each other, and then there was always, you know, an exchange of cultures in the process of meeting. And so when borders were erected, when there was segregation in South Africa of ethnic groups, it was an attempt to stop that. You know, and so for me, it's breaking again, you know, those border lines. And I say, you know, I don't want to be confined to a certain form or structure or place, but I want to experience the other. And I want the other to also experience me, you know. And so I allow this process of trade to happen. You know, and just to break those borderlines and to allow us to be familiar with each other. And I think, you know, a part of the problem in Africa is that we've been separated for far too long. And that's why, you know, there isn't any negotiations between Africans, but there's negotiation between Africans and the West. You know, and that has created major problems. I mean, it's very difficult even for artists in Africa to come together, but it's very easy for an African artist to work with a European choreographer or writer or filmmaker, and that has been made extremely easy. And it's because also there is support, you know, from the West for that to happen, but it comes with its conditions. You know, in order for this to happen, you have to collaborate with someone from the West, and then we will fund your project fully. You know, and it's been hard. And I know we've also, from my example, with Fostan from Congo, we collaborated on our first piece in the year 2000, and it was commissioned by a festival in Vienna. We couldn't do it in Africa. The condition was we had to go to Vienna and create that work in order to qualify for that funding. And again, you know, it came with parameters. It came also with ideas that, and again, with preconceived ideas of how the work should look like. So it was already kind of framed, you know, for us. You know, because already there were messages sent to us to say, you know, well, you know, it will be interesting for the West to talk about AIDS, to talk about war in Africa, to talk about this and this. So already we were channeled into a kind of what, you know, is interesting for the West, but they already forgotten about what is interesting, you know, about Africans. You know, about their own situation. What is it that they want to say about themselves?
So we have a comment from Hema, and after that we have time for maybe one more question or comment.
It's in response to what is tradition and how one interprets it, I guess. For me, it has always meant, as a teacher, that I try to bring to my students the essence, and I emphasize essence, of what I learned. And the reason I say that is because after having been in the field for the number of years that I have, the footwork that I learned has gotten increasingly more difficult. It is not the simple footwork that I learned way, way, way back there. It was probably influenced by being on the stage all these many years. I don't really know, but it has gotten more difficult, more elaborate, much more complicated. And so I teach what I learned and has been influenced by the time I have been in the field. Is it the same tradition? Is the intent still the same? Yes. But time has changed certain things. And not necessarily by me. You go to Mexico and you see these dances that the grandparents taught and whatever. They are not the same dances with the same music that are being learned now. So.
Yes. And while, yeah, go ahead and but Russell just wanted to respond.
Well, actually, I want to respond to Ron. Okay. Hey, Ron.
Yeah. Why don't you go first?
Okay. Yeah. You know, I think you bring up a really important question of the idea of theft. You know, or it, and it's not necessarily. I don't know if theft's the actual term, but I know what you're getting at. But you also bring up the idea of horizontal movement, and I think exchange is the important idea. And I'm, because I think, you know, one of the thing is what we're dealing with is ideas of canonization for one, on one aspect, and then we're dealing with globalization on the other aspect. And so the idea of in ideas of canons, this is when you define certain things. You know, you think about like Wynton Marsalis with the Lincoln Center right now, and he's defining what jazz is and what it isn't, which is a really problematic process. But there also are these issues about, you know, I was thinking a lot, I wrote a paper one time on about Osomatli, and thinking about their kind of utilizing all these kind of world music. And then you get to this idea and you listen, if you like analyze what they're doing, it's like basically playing this pentatonic scale and abusing it, you know, to it all extents. You know, you don't know if it's supposed to be influenced by a Jewish, you know, kind of Jewish music, Spanish music, Arabic music, or, and, but they're utilizing it in this kind of signifying manner of certain community. And so, and but so there's a real weird tension there of, you know, well, are you signifying, are you stereotyping, you know? And I think this is some of the things that I would think about, you know, from your comment, and I think, but it has to come back to what's the exchange, what's the dialogue that's going on between them and those other communities, you know, or any artist and those other communities that, you know, the idea of stealing is, hey, we all steal, you know. It's like when you know, a good musician borrows a lick, a great musician steals it, you know, and makes it their own. That's the bottom line to it. But I think this, but there has to be dialogue, yeah. and to make some, have some substance.
Absolutely. And I also think, you know, it's also, I mean, a big word for me which is really important is appropriation. Of really understanding what you're dealing with, and going into greater depth, you know, of really understanding the other tradition, the other form that you're dealing with.
And that very topic is something we're going to go right into in our next panel. But before we do, there's actually one more comment or question.
Yes, I wanted to comment on the lady's question about authenticity. Was that you, Naomi, who asked the question? Hello. It's more to talk about why we, who we are, who are those of us who really seek out authenticity. It's sort of a commentary on that from my own personal perspective and not a last word on it. So I was born and raised in the United States. Both of my parents are African American, born and raised in Alabama, and then I was raised in Chicago. And in the late 90s, I lived in Ghana and studied Ghanaian dance and music. And I had never been to Africa before at all. And I wanted to live in a place where there were only black people everywhere in every part of society, because I knew that there was something very different about that than the African American experience, similar but different, but very different. And before I went to Ghana, there was a woman, a Ghanaian woman who had been living in the United States, who told me probably the most important piece of advice that I got before going there, which was, don't expect anything. Just go and be there. Just be. And because of that, I was able to make Ghanaians real people, as opposed to, I think, for, and I'll speak for myself and my observations about some of us as African Americans, is that the reason why some of us seek out authenticity is because of this separation, because of our displacement. And so there's a way that we sort of make monoliths of people, of Africa, of Africans, you know, of Ghanaians, of West Africans, because we've been moved so far away from an essence, and we need for something to stand still. And so we don't even think about, oh,
traditional music and dance and art forms have innovated up to that point. Of whatever we're studying, there have been a series of innovations, and the idea of traditional dancers, you know, or traditional artists never innovating but only copying what came before them, if we think about it rationally, it doesn't make sense. But I think because a lot of us are a part of the diaspora for reasons of colonization, enslavement, we sort of really seek out this thing of authenticity because we need something, because we've been pulled away so far from an essence, from a core. There's that feeling that we always walk around with. So again, it's not a last word, but just a commentary on this idea of why we seek out authenticity and who we are, who do, versus oftentimes folks, if you grew up in Africa, if you grew up in Ghana, you just are. Everything you do is authentic because that's where you're from, you know. And so it's not like me, who's an African American who goes to Ghana, and as much as I'm connecting on a soul level, there's also an anthropological part of me that's like, wow, look at the way they interact. That's so authentic, or that's so wow. I'm an anthropologist partly because I've been separated. There is an essence in me that is African, but there is a huge piece of separation. And so I just wanted to share my personal perspective on that idea of authenticity.
Thank you. Thank you so much. We are out of time with this panel. The day is young, but before we close, I just wanted to thank Gregory Makoma and Russell Rodriguez and all of you for coming this morning, and Lily as well. So.
Thank you all so much. And as Sherwood said, this has really segued nicely into our next panel, which is about appropriation and authenticity and questions around identity and who gets to perform these kinds of movements. So that's going to be really interesting. I hope that all of you are staying for that. But if you're not, I want to give you some suggestions in planning your weekend. Gregory Makoma is performing one final night at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. I hear that it may sell out, so I would suggest getting tickets. And then I would suggest coming back tomorrow night on Sunday to see the performance at Counterpulse. Hema Sandoval, who spoke, is going to be performing, as well as Adia Whitaker, who's teaching Electem later today. And you can actually purchase tickets for the Counterpulse performances in our lobby. And if you're staying here all day, we might even be able to hook you up with a computer so you can purchase tickets for the Yerba Buena performances tonight. So that we can all just stay together all weekend and keep talking about these things. We are going to take a quick 10-15 minute break, and then we'll come back with the next panel.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.